Hi, my name is Brank Amaletic, and you're listening to Talking Architecture and Design, brought to you from the Architecture and Design Network. Today, I'm delighted to bring you the first of our five podcasts in our 2023 Commercial Design Series, proudly brought to you in association with GH Commercial. As the oceanic subsidiary of Mohawk Industries, the world's largest flooring company, GH Commercial belongs to a global network of leading products, brands, and world-class manufacturing. Drawing on over 150 years of local manufacturing experience through Godfrey Hirst operations, we proudly operate 4 carpet manufacturing facilities, 3 yarn processing facilities, 10 distribution centres and 14 sales offices across Australia and New Zealand. And we know that our future depends on the work we do today. Our commitment to our planet extends beyond just products and processes. It's how we challenge ourselves every day and it guides our future decisions. Our approach to sustainable business is all about making the world better. We capture this in 3 powerful pillars of people, performance, and planet in everything that we do. Proudly a active carbon neutral organization. For more information, go to www.ghcommercial.com.au. Today we have with us Royce Epstein from lovely Chile, Philadelphia. Royce Epstein is a seasoned professional with 3 decades of experience in commercial interior design and architecture, spanning a diverse range of roles, including interior designer, product designer and developer, and university lecturer and educator. Her passion lies in understanding the intricacies of materials, how they are made, how they are used, and most importantly, their impact on our planet. She has created a series of continuing education units to share her lifelong learning of materials with the commercial architecture and design community. She joins us today, rather, from, as I said, from lovely Chile, Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love in the US, apparently, and to talk to us about the latest trends in urban design and how they are being influenced by what she calls the culture of care in design. So welcome to Talking Architecture and Design, Royce Epstein.
Thank you so much, Marco, for having me. I'm really thrilled to speak to you and your audience in Australia and certainly the architecture and design community. I personally have never been to Australia and I'm really excited to visit someday. So hopefully this will be like putting those good vibes in the air that I will, you know, connect with some, you know, fellow design lovers in Australia and hopefully bring me there to your market soon enough.
You can go over any time. I believe it takes about 30 hours from where you are.
Anyway. So several flights.
Yeah, true. Okay, so you work for the Mohawk Group, don't you? So can you please explain who they are? There's a relationship to GH Commercial there, isn't there?
Yes. So Mohawk Group is the commercial division of Mohawk Industries. So we design and sell carpet and flooring for the architecture and interior design industry here in the US and Canada, and then other international places around the world like Latin America. We have other sister companies around the world that are owned by our parent company, Mohawk Industries, and Godfrey Hirst is one of them. So we have a wonderful kind of sister brother partnership, if you will, with GH Commercial. Joel, who I know you know from GH, he actually is from Pennsylvania, where I live. So that's kind of cool. It's always fun for me to talk to him because he has an Aussie accent. But we have a wonderful relationship. We share a lot of design trend information, a lot of product overlap and whatnot. So really good synergy there.
Okay. Well, Yes, he is from Pennsylvania. I remember him telling me that. You have 30 years experience under your belt in the world of commercial interior design and architecture. So can you tell me what are some of the single biggest changes that you've seen, let's say, in the near past, if I could call it that?
Yeah, well, I started in 1992, and I was very lucky. My first job was for the architect Michael Graves, and back then, we didn't have any technology really in the industry or certainly in our office. We had no AutoCAD, everybody drafted by hand. I remember the day our fax machine was installed, and that was a really big deal. So, of course, over the last 3 decades, we've seen so many changes brought on by the digital revolution. You know, I didn't have email or basic internet 1.0 until I started at my second job at a large architecture firm called Hillier, and that was in the mid 90s. And that changed so many things, along with the invention, of course, of FedEx, because then speed entered our industry, right? So, you know, I used to order samples on the telephone, and it would take almost a month to get a wood sample or a carpet sample. And of course, nowadays that's completely unacceptable, right? Because our timelines have compressed and our industry has really shifted into a world of very fast-paced deadlines. And then, you know, Internet 2.0 came along with social media, and certainly our tech devices have gotten smaller and smaller and portable to allow us to communicate in all sorts of ways and not be tethered to our desk. And that's, of course, changed how we all behave as humans, but also how brands interact with consumers. And now we're kind of really at the start of Web 3.0, where we can interact in the metaverse, for example. So,
So can you explain what exactly is the culture of care?
yeah, so every year at Mohawk, we develop a theme that helps drive our product development. And the theme is really meaningful to us. It's not just a trend topic. Or something, you know, interesting that's happening. It's really something meaningful that, again, is driving culture and therefore the language of design. And so we're always looking at all kinds of cultural shifts that are happening to sort of give us insights into where the future is headed. And that's a big part of my job at Mohawk. I think I have the best job at Mohawk. That's really fun to do that. But it comes with a lot of responsibility, of course, because in a way I'm looking at the future, and then I have to translate that for our company, right? So this year we are talking about culture of care. And you know, this is really a big philosophy about how we should be living today. Culture of care really looks at how we can use design as social practice in the service of care for people. So that's ourselves and others, place, which I define as community, and planet, which of course deals with sustainability and environmental issues. And it also expands, I think, the current definition that we have of care, where we're starting to really prioritize that designers must have an ethical responsibility to use our design work to express care. So it's no longer good enough to just build giant objects like skyscrapers and call it a day. Like, we have to care about people, place, and planet. So that's culture of care.
Okay, so that actually, it's problematic to actually ask you another question is, in that case, is there a change from culture driving design to design driving culture, is what you're saying?
Wow, that's a big like philosophical question.
Just a yes and no answer, thanks, Royce. No, just joking. No, but it is different. With what you're saying is with the culture of care. You seem to be saying that now, design is really dictating to how we should, how we should treat the earth, yeah.
100%. And you know, I've been in this dream long enough, and you know, this goes back to your first question. You know, when I started in 1992 working in architecture and interiors, nobody cared about, you know, materiality or sustainability, or
Yeah.
I mean, that really didn't come around, at least in the US, as a part of our design discipline until the late 90s, early 2000s, like when LEED first came on the scene, and you know, learning about recycled materials. I mean, that was sort of the early days of sustainability. And now, you know, we've, you know, fast forward 20 something years, and sustainability has become more of a strategy about how to mitigate all of these giant problems that we have, because we have a lot of them. You know, climate disaster. I mean, that's obviously the biggest one that comes to mind for all of us, but pollution and waste streams that, you know, do not go away, and whatnot. And of course, all of this has a social impact component as well. And so, you know, I like to think of it as, you know, as we, as an industry, and also the whole world, because the world, you know, we're not the only industry dealing with this. The fashion industry certainly is dealing with this, and auto industry and many others. It's like, how do we get to a place where we're no longer doing harm, but instead we're regenerating our planet? I talk a lot about how, maybe sustainability is not even the right word for us anymore, because to sustain is not enough. That's not healthy enough anymore. We really need to regenerate our planet so that our planet can be healthy and therefore we can be healthy. So it's kind of basic, but it takes a long time for these messages. It's like, you need mindset to have action. So I think right now we're still in that mindset phase of like everybody learning and trying to accept that climate change is real and here are all the problems that we have in the world. And then how can we come together as a design industry to tackle this? And I do think the design industry is leading a lot of those efforts, which is great.
You're right. I mean, and there's been a lot of talk here as well about obviously the fashion industry, which you mentioned, about fast fashion and its impact on, and as you say, sustainability. I'll put that in air quotes. You can't see that, but it's on me doing air quotes. It's that term, that word we've spoken about, consistently to try and find a better word. Because you're right. It's not just about, well, okay, great. We're still here in the iron lung. Fantastic. Maybe we could move on, move a little, evolve from that. Anyway, let's talk about anthropologists as we do. So tell me about Margaret Mead, the cultural anthropologist, regarding the culture of care and how her work fits in with what you're doing.
Yeah, so first of all, when I was doing my research for culture of care, and I should mention that I didn't come up with the term culture of care. I learned about it from an editor of Architect Magazine, my dear friend Paul Makovsky, and we often talk about all the big issues of our industry, and he had introduced me to this term, and I thought, wow, like this is exactly what I, have been thinking about and trying to come up with a word that describes like how we need as designers to really care about the impact of what we're doing. So then I would, just in all my research, I came across this famous story about Margaret Mead. She's the famous cultural anthropologist, where a student had asked her a question at a lecture about what was the first sign of human civilization. And she said that the first sign was a healed broken femur. So that's the thigh bone in a human. Because in nature, going back to animals, if an animal breaks its leg, it dies. Like it can't hunt, it can't run from danger, it can't, perform any tasks for survival. And then, of course, it becomes prey for other species in the wild. So, a broken human femur that has healed, in her opinion, was evidence that somebody nurtured that person and protected them for survival. And so that was really in her mind where civilization starts, where there's evidence where humans start caring for other humans. And there's a lot of discussion whether that story is accurate or not, but I think it is such a poignant example about you could think about if humans in the wild back in the day, we might have been one like everyone out for himself, but something happened where we had connection and we had emotional connections and families and things like that. And I can imagine that's where care really starts, right?
Speaking of which, you've written about this extensively. You wrote, one of the many things that you've written is, when we design with care culture, we expand past what we think of as design for care. We no longer are just focused on spaces for healthcare, but instead embed care concepts into space and place. Okay, so what does that look like?
Well, culture of care proposes that we don't just receive care in buildings, like a hospital, for example, or medical building, or spaces that are dedicated to healthcare. I think if you ask people, just the general public, to tell you about care, most people would probably hone in on some kind of answer about healthcare. But care happens everywhere in many aspects. So, designers really need to embrace that thinking to create new space typologies. Spaces such as spas, even biohacking centers, that's sort of the new cutting edge version of self-care, where we can, do things to our body to live longer. I think we can design housing that is more human-centered. We can have educational spaces that support students' well-being. I mean, even in the workplace, and especially in the workplace, offices that embrace more than just, productivity, that was sort of like, in the era of the 80s and the 90s, like the endless workstations and heads down and be at your desk. And, that kind of productivity was really demoralizing for people. And I think it still is. And that's why there's a hesitancy for people to return to the office because people want to hang on to the self-care that they can have in their home environment or being out in nature, you know, wherever it is they want to go and do their work. You know, so I often think about questions like, you know, can we embed optimism into spaces? You know, what about inclusivity, you know, wellness for physical, mental, and emotional health? I mean, these are so important. And, you know, can spaces like not induce anxiety and instead really help us heal from all the trauma in the world? I think these are some of the questions that certainly a lot of the design firms in the US are talking about. And we're talking about this at Mohawk. And I do think this is going to be the next generation's work in design, is to, you know, design within a culture of care.
Yes, no one has ever missed a cubicle, have they? I was going to say, so what is the caring economy? There is an economy here, isn't there? There's a growing sector.
Yeah, well, first of all, we haven't ever had a caring economy, honestly, because if we had, then I think lots of places around the world would be in great shape and not have poverty and not have sick people. And, you know, our healthcare system in the U.S. is kind of a mess. And it's a definite, you know, victim of capitalism, I should say. So if we imagine a caring economy, this is an economy that prioritizes people over things. So we're valuing people instead of materialistic and capitalistic stuff like profit, right? Or, you know, just the things that we collect or care about, like cars or, you know, things like that. So in a caring economy, like all would be treated to access to care. And that could be, of course, through the medical system and traditional care-based elements, but also community-based support and benefits for all of society. And something that really is more holistic, like looking at, you know, self-care, investing in your own, like mental health, for example, child and family care and elder care. I mean, we are, again, in the US, we're really bad about these things. So this is essentially, I think, not just for, you know, individuals' well-beings, but for really investing in communities. When you have a healthy community, you can grow new economies, right? And with the rising cost of healthcare, you know, consumers are also seeking more alternatives to incorporate wellness into their lives outside of that traditional healthcare space. So I think this new focus on care is going to be a driver for not only new designs and new products and new space types, but just, again, a new mindset that will move action forward to boost the economy. And I think, you know, even, not that AI is related to this, I mean, it can be related to this, but you just think about AI, like AI is also going to create a whole new economy of in ways we can't even imagine quite yet. So I think if we think about care in that way, absolutely. You know, just think about, like, right now there's such a trend of, like, and I have a lecture, a culture of care, where I talk about all of these issues, but I give the example of how, like, in the wellness market, you know, people are ingesting edibles and, you know, whether it's like microdosing mushrooms or, you know, CBD gummies or whatever it is. And that market is huge. I mean, huge. I can't remember like the actual number, but I think it's rose like 200% since COVID. Right. And that's an economy, you know, the cannabis economy or the mushroom economy. Like, these are new economies that people hadn't really thought about legally, you know, before. So I do think the caring economy will hopefully be more, again, holistic and welcome some of these methods to take care of people and also let people take care of themselves.
Interesting what you said about aged care too, and how, you know, you're not good at it in the US. I don't think they're good at it anywhere in the world. Well, they may well be in some Scandinavian countries, but certainly Australia is not that far from the US. And then it reminds me what you said about Margaret Mead. It's an interesting juxtaposition there, isn't it? Okay, so let's talk about the concept of designing waste to be valuable. And now, is that like what they call a circular economy?
Yes, exactly. So I talk a lot, besides the culture of care, I also talk a lot about using waste in design. I'm very interested in materials and how materials have evolved from classic materials that we've used in architecture and design, you know, since the Industrial Revolution. And now, of course, we have this whole other amazing movement of bio-based materials, waste-based materials. So I look a lot at that. And I think that, you know, waste can be really valuable. And what I mean by that is it could be a new economy, just like we were talking about. But it's valuable in that we can also, you know, prevent waste from going to landfill and we can turn it into usable materials and products. So that is, you know, when I talk about waste being valuable, that's really what I mean. And yes, it's all about circularity. You know, the goal is to avoid having things, go to landfill. Now, we're living in the Anthropocene today. I'm not sure if your listeners have heard that term before, but the Anthropocene is just the era that scientists have deemed that we're living in today, where mankind has caused all the damage and destruction to our actual physical planet, mining, and I mean, construction is definitely in there, burning of fossil fuels, all of that. And we have generated so much waste and pollution. We've contributed to climate change with the rise in CO2 emissions. And of course, it's all compounded with all the off-gassing from landfills. I mean, landfills also contribute a hearty amount of CO2 emissions. So, we have enough waste, if you think about it, to not make new virgin products anymore from petrochemicals. And we should be doing that. I mean, it's like shifting our mindset instead of making everything from new materials. Like, let's use waste that we have. I think about this, like every piece of plastic that's ever been made, most plastic really started in the mid 20th century, but some plastic started earlier, but all of it still exists somewhere. I mean, that's a little bit frightening, right? Like it doesn't biodegrade. And when it breaks down, it just breaks down into smaller pieces and then turtles swallow it or whatever. It's terrible. So I'm really a huge advocate of material circularity, like using recycled plastics. I know a lot of people want to avoid plastics altogether, but I think we have to solve for what's in front of us. Like we already have all this plastic. There's nothing to do with it other than figure out how to reuse it.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. We are indebted to GH Commercial, whose sponsorship of the 2023 Commercial Design Series makes all this possible. As the oceanic subsidiary of Mohawk Industries, the world's largest flooring company, GH Commercial belongs to a global network of leading products, brands, and world-class manufacturing. Our portfolio includes carpet tiles, residential and commercial broadloom made with wool and synthetic fibers, woven carpet, designer jet carpet, engineered timber, hybrid laminate, vinyl plank, as well as a range of custom flooring solutions. Drawing on over 150 years of local manufacturing experience through Godfrey Hirst's operations, we proudly operate 4 carpet manufacturing facilities, 3 yarn processing facilities, 10 distribution centres, and 14 sales offices across Australia and New Zealand. And we know that our future depends on the work we do today. Our commitment to our planet extends beyond just products and processes. It's how we challenge ourselves every day, and it guides our future decisions. Our approach to sustainable business is all about making the world better. We capture this in 3 powerful pillars of people, performance, and planet in everything that we do. We are proudly a climate active, carbon neutral organization. And now it's back to the show.
Neuroaesthetics, which links brain activity to creativity, notes that pleasure is the result of stimulus. From looking or interacting with art has a direct result to design. In fact, up until modernism and postmodernism, it was one of the main drivers of design. Okay, how do you see practically using neuroaesthetics in terms of design in the 21st century?
Wow, that's a big question. So I'm not an expert in neuroaesthetics, but I do have a lot of expertise in art history. That was really my background before I got into design. And I do understand that the emotional connection between people and place is quite tangible for people and very expressive, right? And more specifically, buildings can be improved through artistic interventions. The built environment also has a direct effect on our feelings and our behaviors. And we've all been to places that are really inspiring, and we've all been to places that are really demoralizing. And a lot of it is just from looking at, our surroundings, in that building or that space. I do think as designers, like we all want to create spaces that have positive impacts on people. So again, this is related to care, right? Like some are through design interventions that allow for really tangible, positive outcomes. And some are more based on how we feel in a space, which is where neuroaesthetics come in. By using design elements that are pleasing to our senses, especially the visual, through our eyes, we can immediately tell if we feel happy or engaged in that space or even welcome, or the opposite. We can tell when a space feels hostile or scary or even unsafe. you know, let's you walk into like a dark parking garage and like you don't feel good, right? So you feel like, oh, I'm gonna look over my shoulder. So the design of a space, and that includes everything from daylighting and, you know, artificial lighting to, of course, all of the design elements and finishes and whatnot contribute to that. I was just in San Diego at the Salk Institute, and it was designed in the 1960s by the architect Louis Kahn. Most people would classify his work as brutalist architecture. And if you're not familiar with brutalist architecture, it's very heavy, very oppressive. Like it looks like it might fall over like a big block. Not to sound so dismissive, because I'm not. I love brutalist architecture, but I think the common person would describe it that way. Now, when you visit the Salk Institute, it's exquisite. And it's like I've really had to think about why is it so exquisite, because the buildings are all concrete and teak and they're like really solid and heavy. But then you look at all of the design details and they're there to really elevate that experience of sort of connecting with not just the buildings, but there's a whole plaza there and it's designed right on the beach for you to look at the sunlight as it comes through the plaza. It was really an emotional experience. And I then sort of got it and understood like this is a great example of neuroaesthetics, you know, where my brain is like understanding that even though these are massively large chunks of concrete, there's something amazing happening by the way the form and material was treated and different slits in the concrete to allow the light through, for example. So I think that, you know, sometimes we're not even aware like what our brain is doing when we're encountering architecture or, you know, some kind of interior space. But good designers know how to do that so that immediately when we're seeing these devices, if you will, I mean, they are interventions, you know, like our brain gets it and we're like, oh, like I feel really good in this space. Whereas if it didn't have windows or the slits to let the daylight in, it might feel like a prison, right? So it's really all in those in design interventions that allow people to connect with kind of what their brain is doing when they're looking at things, but also their emotional side.
Okay, so on that thing, one of the concepts that, well, this, I think this is kind of related. One of the concepts that you promote is social impact meets neighborhood revitalization. What exactly does that mean? And can you give me an example or case study where this concept was successfully?
Yeah, I like this topic a lot, and I also talk about this a lot. I mean, there are so many communities around the world that have been poorly designed and then therefore neglected due to things like, of course, social injustice, but also just negatively impacted, whether it's from budgets or climate disaster. I mean, there's so many other things we could apply there. So I think one way to build healthy communities is to design again with care of place. So when I talk about culture of care, it's care of people, care of place, and care of planet. And here it's really thinking about place. So as designers, like we have to consider how our projects affect all people. So I always ask myself these questions, and I was an interior designer before I became a product designer and researcher and whatnot. And you know, I think about this a lot, like, is the project respectful to all parties? So all the stakeholders, so not just the owner, but obviously the end user who's using the space, but the staff who works in the space. You know, even the cleaning staff, everyone who encounters this building, it's for them. It's not just for the owner, right? And then what about the community that interacts with this building and the people who are working in this space, right? There's a great example I came across. It's in Queens. Queens is one of the boroughs of New York City. It's a mixed-use project designed by a firm called ODA, and the project scope is 5 blocks, and it was planned to give back 2 acres of open space for the community. And it included health and wellness facilities, affordable housing, dedicated units for unhoused people, and it will create thousands of jobs when it's finished and it opens to the public. So this project was part of New York City's response to the pandemic, where it took underutilized city space and then created a vibrant, walkable community that will have streetscapes and playscapes, it'll have programming for the arts. It'll have a grocery store to prevent a food desert. So the project shows that you can design buildings and community for client while at the same time serving like a larger population within that culture of care. And I think that's so important today. And I know just from all my conversations with designers who talk about, you know, DE&I, diversity, equity, inclusion, social justice, this is really at the top of the wish list of things that we need to move the needle on in our industry.
Is there perhaps with designers a bit of a disconnect that one and the other are actually the same thing? I mean, this is a sort of a very sort of, I'd say overall overarching question, but do you think perhaps there's a bit of a disconnect that the two things that you mentioned are actually one and the same?
Oh, there's definitely a disconnect. I mean, when I started my career, I worked for Michael Graves. He's one of the most famous American architects of his generation. And, it was a what we call a starchitect here in the US. And it was sort of like what Michael said goes. Now, that's not to say I didn't have a wonderful experience there and learn a ton and was very grateful, but it was one experience of, Michael had a unique design language and clients hired him for that visual and that experience. It was still humanistic, and Michael had a great sense of humor about him and also had a deference to classical design and things like that. But you're still getting a Michael Graves building. It's not really, at least back when I was there in the 90s, very different. I think today the firm has moved into much more human-centered design, especially since, Michael, I don't know if you're aware of what happened to him, but he had gotten very sick and paralyzed and then spent the last years of his career really dedicated to human-centered design, especially for disabled occupants of buildings, and really working on ways that every buildings can be more accessible to everybody. And so that was unfortunate for him that he was sick, but a blessing for our industry that a lot of us got to learn from that. I think our industry has not been sort of kind to maybe that's not the right word, but I don't think we've embraced design for all in a very good light. The traditional model of, at least in commercial architecture, is that, a client, maybe it's a Fortune 500 company, hires a design firm. You design a corporate headquarters for them. They have a very specific program in need, and design firms design it. And usually it's a beautiful space, and sometimes it gets published. The client moves in, and that's it. And that's sort of the model. And I don't think for all these years we've actually talked about human-centered design and design serving community, and even something called participatory design, which is talking to the community and finding out what the community needs as part of this building. And it might be a private company that's building the space, but what can they do to connect with the community? I think this is something now that designers want to do and talk more about. So I've been advocating sort of a blowing up of the system, which is, because our system here is like the AIA, the American Institute of Architects, has like these guidelines of like project phases and what happens in every phase. And there usually isn't time or fee allocated for research for, even sustainability suffers under this. Like, every client wants a sustainable building, but a lot of clients don't want to pay that extra work for it or the fee for it to fit another phase in, right? And so now trying to add DE&I into that is a whole other challenge. So I think a lot of designers working for these large firms and smaller firms, I think a lot of people are really excited about moving away from this traditional model of design that's been practiced the same way for many years and the same way I was describing from my Michael Graves days into a much more holistic view where we are always thinking about people, place, and plan, always. And that's why care is so important. Talking about culture of care, coming back to that, is so important because we don't just want to make a building that is gonna, block, apart from being built where the rest of the community can enjoy it, or block people's views of the water, or, I mean, we've heard all of those stories where people complain. I mean, here in Philadelphia, we're having a big argument. Our baseball team wants to move downtown right next to Chinatown, and, half of the city is excited because it'll bring jobs and excitement and nightlife downtown. But then the other half is like, this is not really an equitable project because it's going to literally cut into Chinatown. And so, I think it's important that people, and when I say people, I mean interior designers and architects, like take a step back and figure out how do we make the best of the projects that we have. You might get hired. And I've done many of these projects. You get hired, the client wants XYZ. I've designed casinos and all kinds of projects where you're like, I don't really agree with the how much we're spending on marble or whatever. But that's my job. So I have to do the best I can and make the decisions I can and make sure, okay, if I'm speccing materials that are outrageously expensive, let's at least make sure that they're not coming from a place of harm where no child labor was, taken advantage of, or, you get what I'm saying. So it all comes down to sort of harm versus help and how much can we help as an industry rather than harm.
So, on that point, how does rewilding fit into all this? Because it just seems to be going in other directions.
I love rewilding. Rewilding is another favorite. I have so many topics that I love talking about. So rewilding, just to let your viewers or listeners know, is sort of this concept, I guess, that seeks to restore ecosystems to allow nature to thrive, repair, and regenerate itself. So rewilding is about reversing the destruction of the natural world and undoing hundreds of years of domestication, of cultivating landscapes, and of course, building cities. There's so many different kinds of rewilding, but a lot of it is centered around conservation. So things like habitat restoration, protecting and expanding of woodlands, reintroducing native animal and plant species, allowing nature to reclaim space. So rewilding is nature-centric. So it's allowing nature to restore itself from all the degradation that we've caused in the Anthropocene, over the last 200 years. So with rewilding, we can create healthier places for humans and other species to thrive. You talked about when we were getting to know each other before taping, you had talked about music, and there's a song that I love from Talking Heads called Nothing But Flowers. And that song is all about rewilding. They imagine our concrete and asphalt-filled planet, like what if it was covered over by flowers? And what if, like, we're not eating microwave food anymore, we're eating nuts and berries. So I just love that idea. And I love that they were talking about that. That song is probably 20, 30 years old at this point. Thinking about that before, the term was even coined, because I think it was coined in the 1990s.
In other words, it's an idea that, quite literally and quite obviously, dare I say, has an impact on direct impact on sustainability. I know this is going to be the easy question, but how does it improve the lives of the residents? I mean, there are obvious ways. There are the aesthetics. The feel good factor. Like I made the joke earlier about no one misses the cubicle. But are there other ways that the greening of cities impacts the lives of residents?
Yeah, well, rewilding really seeks to, again, reintroduce the benefits of nature. So if we apply that to cities, it's thinking about how do we reintroduce nature into urban communities, right? So it's that idea again of, like, can we grow flowers on our concrete, right? Like, so everything from, like, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, so cities are cooler. We want to, the goal is to improve the health of city dwellers, but also bring nature back into cities where they nature once was, right? So more green space means, of course, more fresh oxygen for people, more gardens, more equals more food, more restored habitats that humans can share. So again, green space, in urban environments where people can actually be outside. I mean, I read a statistic that, like, 90% of our time is spent indoors. I was like, wow, that's, like, shocking. but I can see that. I mean, I feel like I'm inside more than that. I only go outside to walk my dog. It's kind of sad. So, I think to rewild cities and think about, like, positioning these things, like, we need active management of certain aspects to rewild. So, if we think about the opposite now, like, if you have, like, let's talk about the suburbs. So in a suburb, we have lots of McMansions, with manicured lawns. And think about, like, people are putting so much effort to keep these lawns looking, with fake green. Like, even in like parts of the US in the Southwest, like, people are literally spraying their lawn with green paint. Like, people are using pesticides, we're using so much water. Is that really the right thing to be doing? There's actually a book, and I don't remember the author, I don't even know what year it came out, but there's a wonderful book that proposes using all these, like, suburban lawns as gardens to grow food, and our world would be, like, so much better if we all just did that. So to me, that's a really good example of rewilding. And again, the more nature we bring into urban areas, like, the healthier we're all going to be, because we can go outside and experience all of that and not just be indoors all the time, which is not so healthy.
Interesting. There is also another story I read many years ago that I think it was Phoenix in Arizona, where they were paying. I believe that the local authorities were, or the local government was paying the people to rip up their lawns and to put in cacti and whatever the local. I'm not an expert on on semi-arid plants, but whatever the local plants were, so because it would lower the water usage and other issues. Was that
Yeah,
the
that's called xeriscaping with an X. It's one of the few words with an X that I actually know. And it's a really good idea because you're tapping into like native plants that are drought tolerant and they look amazing. I mean, I love when I go to Arizona or New Mexico or whatnot and I see landscapes like that. They're just so beautiful. But that's the idea. And there's another movement called ungardening, which is part of rewilding, which again is just allowing native plants to thrive. And so you don't really have to garden. You just throw some wild seeds on your property, or wildflower seeds, excuse me. And soon enough, you'll have a very lush garden. And what that does is it attracts pollinators like bees, which we really need
Yeah.
because pollinators, especially in honeybees, I think populate like 80 to 90% of all of our food supply. And they are also at great risk right now from pesticides and drought and climate change and, all these other things. Rewilding seems to be the answer to a lot of our problems because it will sequester CO2 when we have more plants and more green space, will attract pollinators, which will create more food. So to me, it makes a lot of sense.
Let's talk about healing architecture, because a lot of this a lot of what we're speaking about, it's kind of a double-edged sword, isn't it? Yes, we're trying to save the planet and make things more sustainable and also help with, flora and fauna, but also we're trying to heal ourselves in a way, aren't we? So is it becoming more popular, or is it something that will take time to become more accepted? What, in your opinion, could make this notion more universally accepted?
I definitely think designers are already creating these new design typologies for healing architecture, and it's going to, I think, forever change how we practice design. So just like we were talking about earlier, like designers are learning that sometimes we cause harm when we don't even intend to, and it's time to really think more carefully about how we, not just design buildings, but whole communities. So there are design firms out there that specialize in this. I don't know if you've heard of Mass Design Group. They're in Boston and they're actually a nonprofit architecture firm. So just
Wow.
like chew on that for a second. Like, yeah. And again, like sometimes you have to change your business model to maybe like make change in the world. And they're, I think, one of the best firms that are doing healing architecture. Like they're going into places around the world where nobody is designing buildings because the infrastructure is so poor. So they're in Rwanda, they're in Malawi, they're like one of the projects I love from them is they built a maternity waiting hospital for women in I believe it was Malawi because they have such a low birth rate because women have to walk so far to go to the hospital and like many of them don't survive. So just by designing a waiting hospital, women can go when they're less pregnant and wait out their pregnancy and have help and then have healthy babies and then be able to go back with their new family to their communities. And so many projects like that are now coming out and we're all learn, a lot of us in the design community are learning about like how to create these kinds of projects and what does it take. And the client wasn't really the client. The client was like a university and like the health minister of Malawi. And like it wasn't like the traditional sense of a client we think of in architecture.
What would be your idea of a perfect designed urban area to get back to what we earlier said? What would be your idea of a perfect designed urban area that embraces the culture of care?
There is a project that's being built right now in Sweden. It's called Stockholm Wood City, and this just sounds so dreamy and ideal. It's going to be the largest urban timber construction project in the world once it's completed in, I think, 2027. It's, I think, 2.6 million square feet. The project's going to have like 7,000 office spaces, 2,000 residences. So it's mixed use with retail and dining. And the goal is to really show that wood is a sustainable alternative to concrete and steel. Concrete and steel we've been using in architecture and interior design for, again, hundreds of years. And both of those materials have proved to be a destructive part of our Anthropocene. Mining for steel, processing that, and then concrete is also one of the biggest, not just CO2 emitters, but has a lot of embodied carbon as well in the whole life cycle of concrete. And so I think a lot of designers and architects are really trying to find these alternatives. For a long time, people have not really been designing with wood, at least on a big commercial scale. So going back to that and thinking about like how would an urban neighborhood feel if we're not looking at glass and concrete and steel, but instead we're looking at wood? And what would that literally feel like? Would you feel like you're living in a forest? Because I can imagine that like maybe I'll feel like a Smurf, like living in, my little mushroom forest or my, tree forest. And that could be really amazing. And I think for a lot of us of a certain age, we grew up with those kinds of references, like the Smurfs and, like thinking about, living in nature and what does that feel like? I do think building with timber in our contemporary era is on the rise. There are lots of pros and cons, and architects are arguing about it. But the thing is, it does sequester CO2 and it will help rewild cities. And I think that's important. I think the second thing that's important, and I have this here where I live now in Philly, is this idea of creating a 5-minute city where everything that you need to survive is in a 5-minute walk from where you live. So, like, I don't need to really drive unless I want to go to New Jersey and go to the mall or something. I can walk to the grocery store. I can walk to the pharmacy. I can walk to the bakery. Wherever I need, I can walk to my doctor. Like, wherever I need to go, it is in a 5-minute walk, or maybe even a, 10 or 20-minute walk. Everything I need is walkable. And I think that obviously promotes healthy lifestyles. It promotes sustainability. The other thing I think is important is we talked about green space, but also something we call third space. So a lot of people probably don't know they're already doing third space, but that's like going to Starbucks and hanging out and working on your laptop or sitting, like in the city, sometimes there's like empty little garden areas between skyscrapers. So sometimes like sitting in that third space and just, being somewhere other than like here in my home office or being, at my desk in, my corporate office or going to school or whatever it is that people do on a daily basis, this third space is getting out of that, breaking out of that, and having social space as well. It's not just heads down space, but third spaces are really important for social connection and inclusivity. And that's how we make connections with other humans and spread love and joy, as we say. So it's important for our well-being, emotional well-being, but also our fitness, because we're getting out and going there to these third spaces.
With everything that you've said today, it doesn't sound like that we have paucity of ideas. It sounds like that perhaps we need to retrain or we reteach our architects and designers. Would you say that?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of these are new ideas, or maybe they're old ideas that are just coming back, after 200 years, because, I'm sure architects from the 1800s didn't worry about all these issues, right? So, I think it's just about educating ourselves. And again, I don't think designers want to cause harm. I don't think they want to create demoralizing spaces. Designers really want to create inspired places for people to be their best, do their best, but also contribute to the planet, the well-being of our planet. It's so important. And again, if our planet is not well, like we're not well. I mean, we are part of nature. We belong to nature. And I think about that a lot. I think with AI coming and robots, like people might not feel that way. People sort of see our world headed in a very technological way, and that's true, but that's even more reason why we need to hang on to our humanity. And I think that for designers, we have to keep pushing the agenda to care about people, place, and planet and really preserve those things.
Royce Epstein, Senior Design Director for Mohawk Group. That was absolutely a fascinating and thrilling talk. Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you, Bronco. That was really fun. Good, thought-provoking questions. I loved it.
No, your answers were fantastic. There's a lot of stuff that I and our listeners will learn. But no, it was great. So, look, again, thank you for. Is it nighttime where you are? I meant to ask.
It's just about, it's going to be 6 p.m. shortly, so dinner time.
So it's time to run off and get that Philly steak and watch the Flyers. Is that right?
More
Thank
like a plant-based dinner, but that's okay.
you. There you go. Thank you very much for your time. And I'm excited to put this podcast up. It was I've got to say it was one of the most interesting ones I've done for a while. Look, have a great day, and again, thank you for everything.
This has been Branko Miletic, and thank you very much for listening to Talking Architecture and Design, brought to you from the Architecture and Design Network. Thanks once again to today's guest, Royce Epstein, Design Director of Mohawk Industries, and of course, GH Commercial, proud sponsors of our 2024 Commercial Design Series. Be sure to check them out at ghcommercial.com. You can also head over to architectureanddesign.com.au for all the latest and greatest industry news, views, projects, people, and much, much more. See you next time.